From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A former CIA officer, Paul Piller, says the Bush administration used intelligence not to inform decision-making, but to justify the decision they had already made to invade Iraq. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Piller, who coordinated all of the intelligence community's assessments regarding Iraq. In response to the Danish cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad, an Iranian newspaper is running a Holocaust cartoon contest. And in response to that, an Israeli cartoonist is running a contest asking Jews to send in their own anti-Semitic cartoons. He says, no Iranian will beat us on our home turf. We'll talk with Amitai Sandi about his contest. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A former senior CIA official, Paul Pillar, has just written that the Bush administration publicly misused intelligence to justify decisions that were already made, like invading Iraq and overthrowing Saddam Hussein. Pillar says the administration went to war without requesting and evidently without being influenced by any strategic-level intelligence assessments on any aspect of Iraq. These are quotes from Pillar's article in the current edition of Foreign Affairs. The article was described in the Washington Post as the first time that such a senior intelligence officer has so directly and publicly condemned the administration's handling of intelligence. Paul Pillar was the National Intelligence Officer for the Middle East in charge of coordinating all of the intelligence community's assessments regarding Iraq from 2000 to 2005. He joined the CIA in 1977. He's now on the faculty of the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University. In its report on pre-war intelligence concerning Iraq weapons of mass destruction, the Senate Select Intelligence Committee said that it found no evidence that CIA analysts had altered or shaped their judgments in response to political pressure. But you say that their investigation would have caught only the most crude attempts at politicization. What did you face that was more subtle in terms of how you think the Bush administration politicized intelligence?
Well, the underlying reality was the awareness among people working throughout the community, dating back to at least the middle of 2002, one could say perhaps early 2002, that the administration's course had been set, that we were going to war. Bear in mind, you're dealing with a bunch of intelligence analysts here who are paid and trained to figure out the policy intentions and course of governments, and they would be pretty obtuse, to put it bluntly, if they hadn't figured out by, say, early summer of 2002, that this particular government was going to war. And against that backdrop and the awareness that any analysis or products that would help to support the rationale for the decision to go to war would be welcomed, but ones that did not would either be ignored or frowned upon. That is the basis for subtle forms of influence that really have nothing to do with pressure.
You say that you were asked again and again to look for a link between al-Qaeda and Saddam
Yes.
Hussein.
Yes.
Did you find one?
Well, what was found, and this has been a pretty consistent story all along with regard to intelligence coverage of that topic, is there were various data points that were relevant to that issue. Even some encounters or meetings held years ago in Sudan. Other kinds of coincidences or two different names appearing in the same place. What it all added up to in the view of the judgment, in the judgment of the intelligence analyst working those particular issues, was that you had two entities, one the Saddam regime and the other al-Qaeda, that were kind of feeling each other out, trying to stay aware of what they were doing, what each other was doing, but no indication of anything that could be described as a patron-client relationship or a sponsor-client relationship or an alliance. There were some of these coincidences and contacts, but that's hardly anything out of the ordinary and not something that adds up to state sponsorship.
You say that you kept being asked, the CIA kept being asked over and over again to look for the link between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. What's wrong with being asked over and over again? I mean, after all, if the Bush administration was considering going to war, as it was, it would certainly want to find out as much as possible. So what's wrong with searching over and over again until you know you've left no stone unturned?
Because this was not intelligence work that was designed to support an operation, support operationally, as opposed to mustering public support back home for it. It was not designed to try to uncover threats that had not yet been discovered. It was certainly not designed to inform a decision that had not yet been made. Instead, it was, in effect, research centering around one particular angle, that is to say, this whole idea of an alliance, which in turn was being used to justify one particular policy decision, the decision to go to war in Iraq. Now, let me hasten to add that the intelligence community needs, thrives on, welcomes as many questions and tasks and queries from the policymaker as possible. But then the community's task is to take that wherever the evidence goes.
So you think the reason why the CIA was asked over and over again to find a link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda was because the Bush administration wanted to link an invasion of Iraq to the war on terror, wanted to link Saddam Hussein to the war on terror?
The whole thing that made the expedition in Iraq politically feasible back here in the United States was the sudden and enormous change in the public mood after 9/11. After that shock, the American public was inclined to take many more risks and assume many more costs in the name of national security than they were before 9/11. So it provided the mood, the context that made it possible. And if that context were to be exploited and used for that purpose, then it follows that this linkage between this horrible event of international terrorism and Saddam's regime in Iraq would have to be established, emphasized as much as possible. So that's really what that was all about.
Do you think that the Bush administration misrepresented the information that the CIA found on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program and its weapons capability?
There's a substantial difference between that issue and the issue we've just been discussing, which was the supposed relationship between Saddam's regime and al-Qaeda. On weapons of mass destruction, it's really different because, as is well known and as the president has correctly stated, the perception, not just among the U.S. intelligence analysts, but just about anyone else who was following the issue in this country, as well as foreign intelligence services and governments, that those perceptions constituted what amounted to a worldwide consensus that, yes, there was something there. This consensus that Saddam Hussein was doing something with unconventional weapons programs was supported by, of course, his own behavior in making things difficult for the international inspectors and so on. So in that regard, it really was fundamentally different. There were particular matters of emphasis on this or that data point that where there would be problems in the minds of intelligence analysts. The one example that is, I think, best known was the reference to the alleged purchases of uranium ore from Africa, from Niger, that were mentioned in the State of the Union address in 2003. The intelligence analysts who were dealing with that had suspicions about the credibility of that report, which ultimately proved to be totally fraudulent. Those suspicions and those concerns were made known to the White House. The advice was given not to put it into public statements. The intelligence community, in its own unclassified products on the subject, kept it out for precisely that reason. But as we know, the White House then left it in the speech while sourcing it to British sources as a way of referencing it without explicitly vouching for its viability. But for the most part, we should distinguish that issue from the terrorism one.
You write that you thought that most of the intelligence experts thought Iraq was probably several years away from developing a nuclear weapon, and
yes,
that Saddam Hussein was unlikely to use weapons of mass destruction against the U.S. unless his regime was placed in mortal danger. So
yes,
were the reports that you were issuing, would those reports have given the Bush administration the impression that invading Iraq was an important and essential and immediate way of preventing weapons of mass destruction from being developed and from being used against us?
Well, first of all, and we can talk more about this, I think the Bush administration's main motives for going into Iraq had to do more with political change in the Middle East. Some of the rhetoric we've heard more recently from the administration is, in my view, pretty honest in that regard, that this is one way to try to shake up the very sclerotic and backward and authoritarian and unliberal systems in that part of the world, which, as we saw in 9/11, we do need to worry about. They can come back and bite us in a big way. But with regard to the nuclear weapons, you can look at what is now public with regard to the intelligence judgments, and you can look at public statements from people like the vice president and see that there was a simple disagreement. Mr. Cheney, for example, in a major speech in August of 2002, noted correctly that intelligence analysts back before the 1991 Persian Gulf War had underestimated how close the Saddam regime had been to developing a nuclear weapon. He also observed in that connection that intelligence is an uncertain business. And he voiced his own view that Saddam Hussein was fairly close to acquiring a nuclear weapon, which was not the view of the community, the judgment that you just cited.
Did the Bush administration ever ask the CIA for information about what would likely happen if the U.S. invaded Iraq and overthrew Saddam Hussein? What would happen as we tried to create a democracy there?
We were never asked, and I say we, my colleagues and I on the National Intelligence Council. I was the National Intelligence Officer that covered the Middle East, so any request for an intelligence community assessment or a national intelligence estimate, anything of that nature on that subject, would have come through me, and the answer is no, there was no such request. We tried on our own initiative to be as helpful as we could in trying to offer some insights and analysis to respond to precisely those questions. There were some members of Congress who were also, a few members who were asking, very few in fact, who were asking those questions, and in response to which some of our assessments we hoped would serve their needs. But the short answer to your question is no. Not at the policymaker level, anyway. You had, you know, people working very hard at lower levels, initially under General Garner's office, trying to prepare for this, and we did what we could to provide insights and guidance to them. But no, we were not asked for any strategic level insights or assessments of that sort.
My guest is former CIA officer Paul Piller. His article is in the current edition of Foreign Affairs. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Piller. He was the National Intelligence Officer for the Middle East, in charge of coordinating all of the intelligence community's assessments regarding Iraq within the CIA. And he held that position from 2000 to 2005, and he's now at Georgetown University on the Faculty of the Security Studies Program. And he has an article in the new edition of Foreign Affairs called Intelligence Policy and the War in Iraq. You write in your Foreign Affairs article, what is most remarkable about pre-war U.S. intelligence on Iraq is not that it got things wrong and thereby misled policymakers. It's that it played so small a role in one of the most important U.S. policy decisions in recent decades. What do you mean by that, that intelligence actually played such a small role in the decision to go to war?
Well, first of all, in terms of the importance of it, it's hard to think of anything more important as a national security decision than initiating a war, especially initiating an offensive war. But I think the key point to make is this. There was a broad, and as it turned out, mistaken consensus, which the U.S. intelligence community shared, about the state of weapons of mass destruction programs in Iraq, or programs in stockpiles. And precisely because it was so widely shared by Democrats and Republicans in this country, and indeed by European allies and many others who had a very different policy preference from the policy that was decided on, that is to say, a position that was against the war but in favor of using other means, sanctions, inspections, and so on, to try to deal with Saddam Hussein. Clearly, the intelligence on weapons of mass destruction, flawed though it was not the thing that drove the policy, because people who shared that same flawed view had much different policy positions. And so if one were to ask, well, what else would have or should have or could have gone into a decision to go to war, it gets to these other things. The issue of how likely would he be to use any weapons of mass destruction he did have without a war and with a war, and in particular, what the aftermath of that war would be, and what we would have to deal with after overthrowing him, and how messy would be the transition to a more stable and more liberal system in Iraq. Those were the sorts of things where, in fact, intelligence assessments were offered that could have very easily, if you look at the judgments, pointed policy in a different direction, but clearly they did not.
So you think that if all those questions were answered with the information that you provided, that the answers would have led against an invasion of Iraq?
I'm under no delusion that whatever wisdom or insight we were able to produce in the intelligence community would have diverted, this particular set of decision makers from the course that they had set. What I'm saying is that if one were to draw any policy implications from those judgments that the community offered, if there was a policy implication at all, it was more likely that going to war was not the best way of dealing with Saddam Hussein.
While you were at the CIA, did you feel that you could speak out about how you thought the Bush administration was misusing and misrepresenting the intelligence that you were giving it?
Well, my job, like everyone else as a serving intelligence officer, was to continue to provide the best possible intelligence and assessments we could. And that's what we tried to do. And sometimes it was not done well with some of the errors with regard to weapons of mass destruction. In other cases, I think it was done pretty well, such as with most of what was anticipated in the messy aftermath of the invasion. It's not, I guess I would balk at the way you phrased the question, Terry, in that it's not the job of serving intelligence officers to speak out. I mean, there are mechanisms inside the community, an ombudsman and so on, in which concerns can be expressed, and senior management can hear those concerns, and such channels were used. But we're really talking about something much bigger than what any one manager in the intelligence community can deal with.
Well, speaking of going through channels, did you feel that George Tenet would have been your advocate in wanting to make sure that intelligence was accurately represented, or did you think that George Tenet was more representing the Bush administration in wanting to use intelligence selectively to bolster the case for war?
I don't think one should approach this issue in terms of individual leaders or individual personalities. I've been privileged during my 28-year career, which ended last year, in the intelligence community to work with and for some outstanding officials, highly dedicated men and women of high integrity, doing the best they can in what is sometimes often very difficult in high-pressure circumstances. I think someone like Mr. Tenet and others who have filled senior positions, John McLaughlin, who was Mr. Tenet's deputy and for a time was acting director of Central Intelligence, is another one, are people who have served this country honorably and have been in those positions where, I have to tell you, many days when I went to work, I would have to tell myself, I'm glad I'm not in their jobs, being the one to have to go down to the White House every day and really deal face-to-face with people with strong policy inclinations. So we're dealing with a structure and a situation and not with a problem that devolves down to individual personalities.
I'm sure some people listening to you and reading your article in Foreign Affairs are thinking, this guy's covering his behind. The CIA got some things wrong. Like, for example, back in 2001, they didn't see 9/11 coming. So now he's just kind of shifting the blame to things that the Bush administration got wrong. So what would you say to people who are thinking that?
Well, first of all, may I get on the record with regard to 9/11, although every terrorist attack that occurs is at the tactical level an intelligence failure, the strategic intelligence with regard to the threat from al-Qaeda and the possibility of large-scale terrorist attacks in the United States was quite strong. And that not only took place at the classified level, but at the unclassified level. I would just refer you to any of the last, before September 11th, two or three last statements by George Tenet when he was DCI on the subject, in which he highlighted the threat from international terrorism and al-Qaeda in particular, and the possibility of such attacks in the United States as right at the list of his, at the top of his list of security threats to the United States. There's no question that on the issue of weapons of mass destruction, there were flaws in tradecraft. I think with most respects, in most respects, the commission led by Judge Silberman and former Senator Robb did an excellent job of addressing this subject. They went about their work in a very professional way, issued a very thorough report with many excellent ideas. They weren't wedded to any one solution like the 9/11 Commission was. That's a matter of public record. I don't think anybody can dispute that. My intention, my purpose is not to blame this party or that party. It's to highlight an issue that I'm afraid, you know, hasn't been highlighted and hasn't been addressed in a straightforward, nonpartisan way. In a way that isn't just a matter of this is pro-administration or that's anti-administration. We've had so much attention in this country over these last, especially since 9/11, these last 4.5 years or so, on intelligence. And that's all very important. It's all very good. But intelligence will only be as good as its relationship with our policymakers. And until that's fixed, then no matter what you do to the community, and no matter how much reform you attempt, it's not going to have the effect you hope it to have.
Paul Piller is a former CIA officer. His article is in the current edition of Foreign Affairs. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Audible.com. Where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/freshair. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. And from Capella University, an accredited university with bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees online. Classes start March 6th at capella.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the latest in the cartoon culture wars in response to the Iranian Holocaust cartoon contest. An Israeli cartoonist is running a contest for the best anti-Semitic cartoons drawn by Jews. He says, no Iranian will beat us on our home turf. We'll talk with Amitai Sandi about his contest. And we'll continue our interview with former CIA officer Paul Piller. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with former CIA officer Paul Piller. During the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, he was the CIA analyst in charge of coordinating the intelligence community's assessment regarding Iraq. In the current edition of Foreign Affairs, Piller criticizes the Bush administration for misusing intelligence and for politicizing the intelligence community's work. Now, please correct me if I'm wrong here. I believe in August of 2004, you completed an assessment that warned that the insurgency in Iraq could become a guerrilla war or civil war. And then I believe it was also in 2004, you addressed a dinner that was supposed to be like an off-the-record private dinner. You were allowed to, reporters were allowed to comment just on the substance of the report, but to not really quote anything from it. And I believe in that speech you were critical of the Bush administration's decision to go to war. So correct me if I'm wrong in any of this. My understanding is that you were basically accused of trying to sabotage the president's policies after that.
Well, the premise of your question, and this has come up by others as well, is all based on one columnist's version of one leak of one informal talk, which I would suggest is not very good sourcing.
And the columnist you're talking about is Robert Novak. He's also the columnist that reported that Joe Wilson's wife, Valerie, was a CIA agent.
The very same columnist, yes.
Right.
One thing that intelligence analysts, the more senior, experienced ones especially, and certainly former national intelligence officers, as I was at the time, do from time to time for the sake of maintaining our links with expertise in the outside world, is go out and speak to groups, participate in seminars, that sort of thing. And I did give a talk to a small group, a private group, in which I offered some informal views about where things were going in the Middle East and in Iraq. And was asked some questions, answered some questions, but I would not describe that as an attack on the administration. It was pumped up as some kind of deliberate leak of assessments and national intelligence estimates. Nothing could be further from the truth. Mr. Novak portrayed it as my sitting there before a group reading a memo with the intention that it would somehow leak out. I wasn't reading any memo. I'll take that as a compliment to my skills in speaking off the record to a small informal group. Really what you point to, and what the Novak column was just part of, and we should recall this was right in the middle of an election campaign about a month ago before the election, so all of this was highly partisan, highly political, was one of the other things I mentioned in my article, is just how nasty the relationship had gotten, and how the public perception of the nastiness of that relationship, how far that had gone between the intelligence community and the policy community. And, no matter what the issue and no matter who the administration and no matter what party's in power, that cannot be good for the republic. When you have that kind of, ill will, it cannot help the decision-making process.
Let me read you something that New York Times columnist David Brooks wrote. He's a conservative columnist for the Times, and this is a column from November 13th, 2004. Now, he agrees with you that the relationship between the CIA and the Bush administration had become dysfunctional, but he reaches a different conclusion than you do about why that happened. He writes that, quote, "Many in the CIA bureaucracy have waged an unabashed effort to undermine the current administration. The White House-CIA relationship became dysfunctional, and while the blame was certainly not all on one side, Langley was engaged in slow-motion, brazen insubordination, which violated all standards of honorable public service. If we lived in a primitive age, the ground at Langley would be laid waste and salted, and there would be heads on spikes. As it is, the answer to the CIA insubordination is not just to move a few boxes on the office flowchart. The answer is to define carefully what the president expects from the intelligence community. Information." What was your response to this when you saw it?
Well, I agree with that last line. I think it's pretty consistent with what we've just been talking about, Terry, and what I've described as the proper function of the intelligence community. I enjoy reading Mr. Brooks. He's got very colorful rhetoric. I really don't know what he's talking about in terms of insubordination. The proper role of the community, as I described it before, in not trying to substitute for the decisions reached by our leaders who are elected by the American people, is very important. It's taken to heart by the overwhelming majority of people who put on the badge as an intelligence officer, whether they're collectors or analysts or managers. And I just chalk that up in terms of my reaction as one more of those brickbats that you have to put up with if you're going to go to work in this field.
Another thing that you're critical of is some of the oversight committees. I mean, you think that even like oversight committees in Washington have become too partisan, like the rest of Washington. What's an example of that, and how do you think it should be fixed?
There are a lot of, first of all, let me say, I think the oversight process as a whole has worked very well. The House and Senate Intelligence Committees, for example, have an excellent record with regard to safeguarding the secrets that come their way. They perform a very important function, particularly with things like covert action and issues of just what the rules ought to be, some of these controversies that have come up more recently with regard to communications intercepts and so on. There is no substitute for having, you know, committees of the American people's elected representatives serve as a kind of surrogate for the people themselves in making sure that everything the community is doing passes the smell test, if you will. You know, what would be acceptable to the American people if we didn't have to keep all this stuff secret? So that's the first point I want to get on the table. But there's been heightened partisanship on all kinds of things in Capitol Hill, but the one specific thing is this very issue I'm raising. We have not had an open, free, unabashed, not poisoned by partisanship discussion of the relationship of policy and intelligence, particularly on this whole Iraq issue. The Senate Intelligence Committee has said they've been working away on this. I think that's just become a fact of partisan and political life on the Hill, because everything on this issue, and that's one unfortunate thing about it and why I'm trying to phrase it in more forward-looking, nonpartisan terms, is that just about everything you say is immediately translated in Washington into, well, that's pro-administration or anti-administration, or it's Republican or Democratic. I think it's a big mistake to think of this issue that I've tried to direct attention to in those terms.
How do you think our invasion of Iraq and overthrow of Saddam Hussein has been affecting the war on terror?
In my judgment, it's been a net minus with regard to counterterrorism, mainly because of the inspiration it has given to the more extreme variants of political Islam, jihadism. Iraq is now the biggest, most prominent, most salient jihad. We see it being waged every day as we hear about the latest car bombs going off. It clearly was incredibly unpopular, particularly in the Muslim world. It has tended to play into some of the most effective propaganda points that the likes of al-Qaeda have used with regard to the erroneous accusations that the United States is out to oppress Muslims, kill Muslims, take over their resources, all those sorts of things. Very much untrue, but some kinds of events and some kinds of efforts tend to play into those propaganda points more than others. Iraq today is filling some of the same role that the jihad against the Soviets in Afghanistan filled back in the 1980s. In addition to providing that the propaganda points, it provides inspiration, being able to fight a superpower to a standstill. It provides training, expertise in the kinds of terrorist-related matters such as firearms and explosives that could be used elsewhere, and it provides the ultimate extremist networking opportunity, just as we saw in Afghanistan, and the effects of which we're still seeing today with al-Qaeda and its other brethren. So although there are things obviously to be said on the other side of the ledger, on balance, I'm afraid that's the consequence. I would just add the one major caveat, that there are many chapters still to be played out in the Iraq story. Even though we're almost 3 years into this effort, there are a lot of variables that can still go different directions. Critical will be in the several months ahead, how the political story plays out, whether the Shia Arabs and the Kurds will be genuinely inclusive with regard to Sunni Arab interests, for example, and how this goes and how much statesmanship Iraqi leaders show will help determine whether we have more of a morass and mess there, or whether we make some progress toward a more stable as well as a more liberal society.
You wrote this article, and then you went to Europe, and you just got back from your mm-hmm. trip. Is anything surprising you about the reaction that you've gotten in your absence? Because you're returning to the reaction.
In the article I just wrote, there is actually very, very little that's new or any kind of new revelation. That's why I'm a bit surprised. Some of the reaction has been along the lines of as if it were some kind of whistleblowing revelation and an attack on the Bush administration. It's not intended to be any of those things. I'm a political scientist. This is the sort of thing that I'm trained to write about. That's what I've tried to do with this article. It happens to be on a subject where I had some insights to add based on my previous career. And while I was doing that previous career, my job was, as I described before, to try to provide the best possible intelligence to the policymakers of the day. That's the best way I can describe it. And my hope is that whatever did not go right with Iraq, whether it relates to the intelligence itself, the policy itself, or the concern that I'm trying to highlight, how the intelligence relates to the policy, that the next comparable national security issue that comes along, or the next several that come along, that will do it better, that this relationship will be healthier, that the best insights that the community has to offer will be used and listened to, although, of course, the ultimate decisions will still be our elected leaders to make, that there will not be the kind of rancor and obvious ill will between these two communities that grew up so much over Iraq. That there will not be selective use of intelligence publicly that in some cases really goes against the grain of what the government's own experts are judging. So I'm looking forward, not backward.
Paul Piller, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Paul Piller is the former CIA National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. His article on intelligence, policy, and the war in Iraq is in the current edition of Foreign Affairs. In response to the Iranian Holocaust cartoon contest, an Israeli cartoonist has started his own anti-Semitic cartoon contest. He'll explain why after a break. This is Fresh Air. In response to the Danish cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad, an Iranian newspaper started a Holocaust cartoon contest to see how the West really feels about free speech. In response to the Iranian contest, an Israeli has started his own anti-Semitic cartoon contest, and you have to be Jewish to enter. He says, "We'll show the world we can do the best, sharpest, most offensive Jew-hating cartoons ever published. No Iranian will beat us on our own home turf." The creator of the contest is the 29-year-old Israeli cartoonist Amitai Sandi. He publishes alternative comics through his group Demona Comics. We called him in Tel Aviv to find out more about his anti-Semitic cartoon contest. Would you describe one of the cartoons for us?
Sure, we have Moses coming down from the Mount Sinai, and he's holding the commandments. The caption says, "Moses bringing to the people of Israel the secret 11th commandment." And the commandment says, "Don't forget to take over world media."
That's good. How about another one?
Let's see. We have... this is a used car garage or whatever you call it, and we've got two guys standing near a car, and the guy says, "Look, this looks like a pretty nice car, but how many of my Jewish friends do you think I could put in there?" And the salesman says, "Lots. You can put two in front, three in the back, and 6 million in the ashtray."
Oh, gee. Oh, boy. No, I'm trying to decide whether this contest is, like, incredibly smart and funny and a really great way of proving the point that you want to make, or whether it's really kind of sick.
I guess it's both. We've received, I think, hundreds of emails from Jews all over the world. Most of the responses we get are from Jews. And they all say in different words, probably more or less the same thing. They all say, "This is a great idea. This is fighting fire with humor. And this is the reasonable, sane way for Jews to react." And most of them also say, "Look, you made us feel proud to be Jews." There is also one guy from the U.S. who wrote on our website as a comment, "I live in the U.S. My father is Iranian. I really like your idea. I've heard that Jews are planning to take over the world. I hope this happens soon.
That's pretty funny. Assuming he meant it to be funny, that's pretty funny. You know, on the other hand, I read in the Jerusalem Post that the head of the Simon Wiesenthal Center office in Israel says that, you know, it's not such a good idea, that initially a lot of Jews ridiculed Hitler, and it might have been funny at the time, but it wasn't an effective response.
No, I thought he was like, he wasn't that negative to our idea, because he did say that we do have a history of self-ridicule. And, you know, we did a bit of research before we started the competition. We went here to archives of newspapers, and we found many Jewish newspapers from the beginning of the 20th century, around the 19th. We've read and even we have it here, copies of newspapers in Yiddish from Poland and all over Eastern Europe, and yeah, Jews have a really long tradition of self-joking and self-ridicule. We're just continuing the tradition.
What was your reaction when the Iranian newspaper decided to hold a cartoon contest lampooning the Holocaust? If this is their response to the Danish cartoons, they're going to see, you know, what do we really think of freedom of speech? So what was your reaction when their response to the Danish cartoons was, we're going to mock the Holocaust?
Well, I can understand their reason. I mean, the original Danish cartoons were published as an example of free speech, and I honestly believe many of those Danish cartoons weren't so funny to begin with. And I don't mind the Iranians doing Holocaust jokes. I mean, I don't think it's in very good taste, but I don't care. I mean, it's not what's going to matter. I just think that it's cowardice, because, of course, they would never do an anti-Arab cartoons contest on themselves. I just think it takes a bit of more courage to joke about yourself. It takes self-confidence, which they lack, apparently.
Would you have published those Danish cartoons?
No, but not on the same grounds. I would just say most of them are not funny. But I do believe in their right to be published.
Did it bother you that in response to the Danish cartoons, the Iranian paper is basically saying, mock the Jews?
That's nothing new. The Jews are always the easiest target to blame for any. I mean, we are responsible for Katrina. We are responsible for teams losing in sports.
September 11th. September 11th.
Of course, of course. We knew in advance.
So, you know, there's one cartoon that was published. I think I'm describing this correctly. This was it in response to the Danish cartoons. It's a cartoon of Hitler in bed with Anne Frank. And Hitler is saying something like, well, put this in your diary.
Yes, it's a classic. It's not even a new cartoon.
It's not?
No, it's been around for a long time.
Is it funny?
Yes, it's funny. Not hilarious, but it's okay. We've also had one of the first Iranian cartoons published from their competition, I think, is showing Spielberg calling Peter Jackson, saying, I need you to help me on this Holocaust film. And Peter Jackson says, I'm sorry, I don't have enough imagination for this. Which is okay.
That's actually a really interesting cartoon, because that one works both ways. On the one hand, it's a Holocaust denial cartoon. On the other hand, it's saying that the Holocaust is so unimaginable. The horror of it is unimaginable. You could interpret that one almost either way.
It's true, but, you know, one of the things...
I'm sure they didn't mean it that way, but...
I'll tell you, one of the things that I have said in the last few days is that the Holocaust did happen on Earth, and not on any other planet. And I do believe that because there is a danger of a Holocaust happening again, and it has happened again in Africa, and we should talk about the Holocaust. The Holocaust shouldn't be this holy matter that no one can touch. We should talk about it. We should even joke about it. It's important that we talk about everything, because humor is probably one of the most important tools for us to question our values, to question if something is still valid, or perhaps, you know, it's already obsolete and should be changed. And humor causes people to think, at least those people who can think.
Let's get back to the cartoon submissions you're getting for your contest. How are Jews being drawn? Lots of big noses, I imagine.
Yeah, most of the cartoons deal with the stereotype of a religious Jew with the noses, with the yarmulkes and the black, big Eastern European hats and costumes. Yeah, most of them are classics.
Any Jews with horns?
Let's see. No. Many of them with yarmulkes and stuff, and sharp teeth and fangs and nails, but no horns so far. We do have one depicting the Pokemon phenomenon as a Jewish conspiracy.
My guest is Amitai Sandi. We'll talk more about his cartoon contest after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Amitai Sandi is an Israeli cartoonist. In response to the Iranian Holocaust cartoon contest, he's started an anti-Semitic cartoon contest, and you have to be Jewish to enter. Now, are you going to draw an anti-Jewish comic for the competition?
No, probably not. I mean, we still think about it, but as I'm the organizer, perhaps it would be better if I wouldn't. Though I did a couple in the past, but I will have to step this one out.
Would you describe one of them for us?
Well, I did stuff that was political and was more serious in the intent. For example, I did one. I can tell you about a poster I did a year ago. We've had an exhibition called Three Cities Against the Wall. It's New York, Ramallah, and Tel Aviv. Artists from New York, Palestinian artists, and Israeli artists against the separation wall built by Israel inside the occupied territories. And we are all against this wall. We believe Israel should retreat to the 67 lines and let the Palestinians have an independent state on all their territories. And so my entry wasn't directly linked to the war. It's more of a general comment on the Arab-Jewish-Israeli relationship. What happens is when we left-wing people demonstrate here in Tel Aviv, there are always passers-by who shout, "You F with Arabs." And so what I did is depict in my poster, we photoed a white-skinned looking girl with a dark-skinned guy holding hands, smiling to the camera, and the title says, "Yes, I F with an Arab." So what I did is just take this statement and make it into a statement of pride. Because there are mixed couples, for example, today in Israel, mixed Arabs with Jews. But these people could never appear on a public poster because somebody would murder them. So I dream of a day where these things would be a non-issue. But before we can make it a non-issue, it has to become an issue. Kind of like the pride of the homosexuals.
Has it given you any more insights about Jewish humor to see the submissions you're getting and comparing them to genuinely anti-Semitic cartoons?
Well, of course, we Jews make better self-jokes than anyone could from the outside. But I think you in the U.S. should know all about Jewish humor because we already control the humor business in the U.S. So, I mean, from Woody Allen to Seinfeld, and, of course, all the big movie studios, we're in control already. So I think you're already familiar with our talent for a long time.
Well, Amitai Sandi, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Amitai Sandi spoke to us from Tel Aviv. You can find a link to his website on our website, freshair.npr.org. The deadline for his anti-Semitic cartoon contest is March 5th, and remember, you have to be Jewish to enter. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at macfound.org. And from Jane and Gerald Catcher for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Richard Thompson has a new box set of live performances, outtakes, and previously unreleased material. On the next Fresh Air, we hear Thompson performing in our studio. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
She said, "Darling, I'm in love with your mind. The way you care for me is so kind. Love to see you again, I wish I..."